This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will recap LSU's 56-17 victory over UAB Saturday at Tiger Stadium. And also, Carl Friedman, LSU English professor, his latest work, another book about film, this one called Versions of Hollywood Cinema, Studies in Ford, Wilder, Coppola, Scorsese, and others. And we're also slated to hear from Marjorie Essman, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Louisiana. Startling revelations in a poll conducted by the ACLU about Louisianians' attitudes regarding legalization of marijuana. We'll talk about it. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number outside Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. In just a moment, we'll hear from Marjorie Essman, the executive director of the Louisiana ACLU. Congratulations to the New Orleans Saints, victorious in a season opener against an outstanding team. A goal line stand at the end enabled the Saints to prevail 23-17 over the Atlanta Falcons. And the LSU football Tigers are now ranked 8th in the United States of America after pounding UAB 56-17. LSU will face Kent State at home. Tigers have been installed as 37-point favorites over Kent State, which lost by 19 points this past Saturday to mighty Bowling Green. A notable development Saturday, Zach Mettenberger, the Tigers' senior quarterback, fired for 5 touchdowns, also wrote a new chapter in the LSU record book. 8 previous passers from LSU had passed for 4 touchdowns in a game, the last being Matt Flynn in the BCS championship game against Ohio State in 2008, and the first was Steve Ensminger. He passed 4 times for touchdowns to Carlos Carson in a 77-0 demolition of Rice. The date was September 24, 1977. 13,132 days, Steve Ensminger held the record for touchdowns in one game for an LSU quarterback, and he is the current LSU tight ends coach. Now, Zach Mettenberger, who was up and down last year, has accumulated 533 yards, 6 touchdowns through the first 2 games of this year. And if he continues on this pace, he'll complete his senior year with about 3,500 yards and 26 scoring passes. That would place him among the all-time leaders for a single season for LSU. So things look good right now for Zach Mettenberger, who was criticized some last year. And LSU, which lost a lot of players early to the NFL draft, looks to be strong again, ranked 8th in America, although there are 2 future opponents ahead of the Tigers, number 1, Alabama, and number 6, Texas A&M. And this brings us to Marjorie Essman, executive director of the Louisiana American Civil Liberties Union for the last 6 years. And over the last few days, the ACLU has released a survey, a poll of adults 21 and older, about legalization of marijuana in Louisiana for adults 21 and older. Good morning, Marjorie Essman.
Good morning.
Well, the poll, I think some would find surprising, especially in Louisiana. What does it show?
Well, this was a poll of not just adults, but of voters. And it shows that overwhelmingly, voters in Louisiana think that the current sentencing scheme for marijuana is wrong. Overwhelmingly, voters in Louisiana think that our sentences are too long. They would support reducing the current sentences to essentially to a fine or even the possibility of taxation, regulation, and essentially legalization of marijuana, which is surprising. You know, you think of Louisiana as being more of a kind of tough-on-crime sort of place. But I think what this reflects is that people are starting to recognize the difference between crimes that hurt people and crimes that don't. And marijuana is clearly, it's become so commonplace now. You know, everybody knows somebody who at one time or another in their life has been in possession of marijuana, and it doesn't make sense for us to have a sentencing scheme that can lead to 20 years or even up to life for possession of marijuana when we don't have enough money to really combat the serious violent crimes that plague many of our communities. And I think that's what this poll shows.
53% of those surveyed say they support taxing or regulating marijuana. 37%, I think, I'm looking at the numbers, 37% opposed to the legislation and 10% not sure. Now, this was a scientific poll, I assume. You didn't just go down to Magazine Street or the French Quarter. You got people all over the state responding.
Random sample, scientifically conducted, of voters all across the state, every region in the state.
So 53%, that's a solid majority. That's the same number of people, I think, right at the same majority that elected Bobby Jindal as governor in 2007. Do you think politicians will pay attention to this?
Well, I don't see how they can't. I mean, particularly because as you break it down, it shows that even conservative voters think that we need to change our marijuana sentencing scheme. So it's not just a bunch of, you know, liberals. It's everybody. It's across religious groups. It's across racial groups. It's across, you know, the conservative spectrum. So it seems to me that politicians would have to pay attention to what their voters are telling them.
297-5633 for Marjorie Essman, Executive Director of the Louisiana ACLU. During the last legislative session, the ACLU supported a piece of reform legislation, House Bill 103, which was introduced by Representative Austin Baton of New Orleans. The bill would have reduced sentences for marijuana possession and made it more difficult for simple marijuana possession to be used under the habitual offender laws. And that bill didn't go very far. Do you think this will change, or perhaps there's another attempt?
You know, what happened with House Bill 103 is that, you know, it was a fiscal session, it was a shorter session, and by the time it made it to the Senate floor, which it did, they essentially ran out of time to take it up. They would have had to have a two-thirds majority to take it up when they were dealing with the budget and other things, and they kind of ran out of time. So it's not that it didn't go very far, it's that the Senate wasn't able to take it up for a final vote. And I think that this poll makes it clear that the legislature is going to have to address this again. And, of course, this coming session is a full session. It's not a fiscal session. There will be more time to consider things like this. And the fact that 103 got to the Senate floor in the first place means that legislators are willing to have this conversation.
All right.
And this poll shows that the voters want them to have this conversation.
Evelyn asked a good question about how the questions were posed in this poll. Did you give any leading information prior to asking the questions, or how is it done?
Well, we've published the language of the poll, and it's on our website. So if Evelyn wants to see it for herself, I would welcome her to do that. But no, I mean, it was very carefully designed not to lead anybody. I mean, for instance, one question, I'm just sort of picking at random, one question says, would you be more or less likely to vote for a candidate for office if he or she voted to reduce penalties for the possession of marijuana? That's just the straight up and down, you know. Current Louisiana law provides for prison terms ranging up to 20 years and thousands of dollars in fines for, you know, convicted of, you know, simple possession. Do you support or oppose the penalty of long prison terms? We tried very hard to make them just straight up and down. No, you know, we didn't want to influence the results. We wanted to know really and truly what people think, not some, you know, prettified version of it.
Mm-hmm. How much money?
LAACLU.org. If she wants to see the poll results for herself, I would welcome her to look at them.
All right. Well, what about the tax money that would be reaped from a marijuana tax? A levy on marijuana would probably raise some big money.
Well, it would, and of course, it would also cut down on the amount of money that we now spend, you know, nationwide, billions of dollars a year on this war on drugs, which really hasn't done anything productive at all. So it would not only, it would sort of turn everything upside down. It would, instead of being a drain on public resources, it would be a revenue generator.
HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on with Marjorie Essman of the ACLU.
Good morning. Ma'am, I'd like to ask you one question backed up by a statement. In the classified section for jobs, just about 95% of all jobs that are listed in the paper and even online require drug testing. And the fact that marijuana is a substance that stays in the system longer than just about any other drug, insurers who back these companies and offer these jobs are mandating that they don't want people who are testing positive for drugs.
What do you say to that?
Well, that's a very complicated issue. I think that drug testing for jobs, particularly jobs that don't involve public safety, I think is a mistake. I think it shouldn't be done. I think what somebody does on their own personal time is none of their employer's business. Now, if you show up at work impaired, that's a different story. But certainly to test just to see whether somebody is doing something on their own time, I think is a mistake.
We'll return after a little time out here at WRKF with Marjorie Essman, and we'll also hear from LSU English professor Carl Friedman. His book is Versions of Hollywood Cinema, back after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane producing, your number 2975633. Marjorie Essman, the executive director of the Louisiana ACLU. She's held this position for the last 6 years. She is with us for a few more minutes and responding to a poll conducted for the ACLU of Louisiana. 53% of the respondents indicate they would support taxing and regulating marijuana in Louisiana. 37% opposed to the legislation. 10% say they're not sure. Now, have similar polls been conducted in other states, Marjorie?
Well, there have been polls, you know, over the years about different aspects of marijuana, but no other state really compares with Louisiana because our current sentencing scheme is so much harsher than most states. Right now we are one of the very few states that allow somebody to go to prison for life without parole for marijuana possession. And that's an important factor in gauging how people in Louisiana think about it. So I think what a poll from another state might reflect isn't really relevant because our laws are different.
John in Port Allen says the honey badger is an example of how we shouldn't judge people who smoke marijuana. The honey badger is off to a good start in his NFL career. What about Tyrann Mathieu?
Well, you know, I think all of this, I mean, we can laugh, but really I think all of this shows that public attitudes towards marijuana have become, I think, much more realistic. You know, as I said before, everybody knows somebody. And when you think about this as affecting people you know, when you realize that the penalties can be up to 20 years or even life for simple possession of marijuana, and that could be you know, your relatives, it could be your friends, it could be, you know, anybody. It makes you think about it differently.
But in the state legislature, it's hard to find lawmakers who'll even admit they've ever used marijuana, much less vote for legalization. It would seem there's much work to be done, Marjorie.
Well, I'm not asking who's used marijuana, and I don't think that matters, and I wouldn't expect a legislator to admit to having done something that is currently against the law, but the point is that their voters want them to vote differently. And it's not about, after all, whether any individual legislator has used marijuana. It's about whether somebody they know has used marijuana or even whether they think it makes sense to spend public resources on these kinds of penalties for people who aren't doing anything that hurts anyone else. The penalty for drive-by shooting in Louisiana is 5 years. And yet you can get up to 20 years or even life for simple possession of marijuana. That just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Spencer says, I'm reading his email, he says that David Vitter, our junior U.S. senator, admitted to doing something that's against the law, and he got reelected.
That's
so,
<right. laughs>
So what would be the problem with someone admitting they've used marijuana?
Well, I can't speak for, you know, either for Senator Vitter or for what any legislator may have done, but I do think that's an interesting point about the way people perceive, you know, relatively minor infractions of the law. If it doesn't hurt anyone else, why is it anyone else's business?
What happens in the next session? Is this going to be an issue, or are you going to give it a break? What will take place?
No, inevitably this issue will come back up again. I'm not sure exactly, you know, what form it will take. One thing that did pass last legislative session was a resolution, a study resolution by Representative Dalton Honoré, to look at the possible implications of legalization of marijuana, and to report back in time for the upcoming session. So, you know, what happens with that study commission, I think, will shape what the legislation looks like. But it's pretty clear when you've got this kind of support for significant reform, you can't ignore that.
Well, we thank you, Marjorie Espin. Always good to talk with you. Let's do so again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take
care.
Bye-bye. Bye. Carl Friedman, LSU English professor for 29 years, is with us. He is a prolific writer about pop culture, and his latest book is Versions of Hollywood Crime Cinema, Studies in Ford, Wilder, Coppola, Scorsese, and others. You refer to something called the post-heterosexuality of John Wayne. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's an interesting pattern in John Wayne's films, which I actually first started thinking about when I was teaching a course I sometimes teach at LSU on the films of John Wayne. Typically, this doesn't apply to every single one of John Wayne's films. He made about 150. But it applies to most of the best ones. The John Wayne character is generally somebody who has a heterosexual past, but who is no longer engaged in any kind of heterosexual or any kind of sexual activity. It's part, I think, of the construction of John Wayne as the supreme cinematic expression and perhaps the supreme cultural expression of any sort of American masculinity.
Well, the Duke died 34 years ago this summer, and since then there hasn't been another star like him, but there have been some big ones, and many of those are discussed in your book, Versions of Hollywood Crime Cinema. Who are some of the big stars since John Wayne who have the same kind of magnetic appeal on the big screen?
Well, I do think that, you know, as you imply, nobody has actually come along to quite equal John Wayne. I don't think that anybody has ever dominated a single genre the way John Wayne dominated the Hollywood Western, although, of course, he made lots of other films besides Westerns. Most of his best, almost all of his best, I think, were Westerns. In the Western, and perhaps generally, the closest you could come, I would say, would be Clint Eastwood, who, of course, has attained great distinction as a director, as well as an actor. He's probably number two among American screen heroes, American constructions of supreme masculinity. But it's a distant second. I mean, nobody, I think, really rivals John Wayne.
It's hard to envision John Wayne playing in Play Misty for me, though.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Eastwood was certainly a better director. John Wayne directed two films, which didn't turn out very well. Mm-hmm. Certainly a better director. Arguably, I'm not sure I would agree with this, but arguably a better actor. Not quite the same degree of star power. Obviously a great deal of star power, but not quite equal to John Wayne.
Well, in your book, you reflect on crime cinema. And let's start with Martin Scorsese, great director, still doing it, and some great films from Mr. Scorsese. What are your favorites?
My all-time favorite of Scorsese's is Goodfellas, which is the one that I write about at considerable length in the book. I think it's one way that I approach it. I think when Scorsese came to make Goodfellas, he had the precedent of the first two Godfather films by Francis Coppola in mind, which are just overwhelming masterpieces. And I think what Scorsese realized, I think you can see this in the film, he said a few things that I think, you know, somewhat substantiate it too, is that it would be impossible to rival the Godfather films doing that kind of mafia movie. That the only way you could do something of comparable importance mm-hmm. is to do something very different. And that's what he does. In the Godfather films, you've got it's all about mafia aristocracy. It's about the top people in their heavily guarded mansions and their chauffeured limousines and so on and so forth. Goodfellas shows the other side of the mafia, the proletarian side, the street side, people who actually never do make that much money, who are in constant danger, who don't have bodyguards. And it's a very different kind of film.
We're visiting with Carl Friedman, the James F. Cassidy Professor of English at LSU, the author of many books. His most recent was The Age of Nixon, A Study in Cultural Power. His latest that we're talking about today, Versions of Hollywood Crime Cinema. Now, Scorsese and Robert De Niro have done how many films together?
I think about 10 or so.
10.
Together.
10. Was Cape Fear one of those?
Yes. Scorsese did the remake of Cape Fear, which stars De Niro as the villain.
My favorite De Niro film. J.C. Kane, do we have Robert De Niro in Cape Fear?
Counselor, is that you? Counselor, come out wherever you are.
All right, that scares the heck out of people to this day. Nick Nolte was the counselor, cowering in the behind a garbage can, if I remember correctly, as Robert De Niro was coming after him.
Yeah, that's a great film. I think it's one of the perhaps rare examples of a remake that is just as good as the original. The original's a fine film, too.
Well, you alluded to the Godfather series, Francis Ford Coppola. Well, that's what made his career. And if he didn't do anything else, the Godfather series would be one that would last for the ages. Why?
Well, it's... It would be hard to pick, you know, a single film or series of films and say that's the American epic. But if you were to try to do that, I don't think you could do better than to name the Godfather films. It's actually, there's a sort of interesting cultural shift that takes place by the early 70s when the first Godfather film comes out in 72. Most people before that would have said that the American cinematic epic was the Western, you know, not any particular Western, perhaps, but the Western collectively, the Western as a genre. That was the story of America. By the 70s, the Western was becoming less popular. It was losing the position of dominance that it had had in American popular culture for really the entire 20th century up until that point. And this was the new American epic. The American epic seen not as the story of the settling of the West, but the story of organized crime, the story of immigration, the story of non-WASP peoples coming to America and making a life in America, and one way that life was made was by the construction of organized crime.
Why is there this fascination to this day with the mafia?
Well, there's always a fascination with crime because crime is one of the most interesting, one of the most consequential ways that a society defines itself, that it says that, you know, certain things are permissible and certain things aren't. And, of course, that line is always being transgressed. And with the mafia, you have not simply random crime, but you have a criminal organization, which creates a whole other layer, I think, of interest. But there's a further point to your question, which I think is not so easy to answer, and that is why the mafia, of all of the organized crime syndicates, has proven so much more popular than any of the others in film and television. I mean, you know, they've been important. American crime syndicates tend to be organized by ethnicity. There were Irish-American crime syndicates. There are black crime syndicates. And they do have some cinematic representation, but not like the mafia.
Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on with Carl Friedman.
Yes, I was referring to the mob and that sort of thing. I tell you, the fellow that played some parts, excellent, is Charles Bronson.
Charles Bronson. He was a bigger-than-life figure on the screen. Charles Bronson, do you like him?
Not one of my favorite actors. I like some of the work he did in the westerns, probably more than his contemporary films. He's best known, I guess, for the Death Wish films, isn't he?
You know, he was once a roommate when he was just starting with Jack Klugman, and Klugman said they were so poor they used to steal from neighbors' refrigerators. Things got a lot better for both Charles and Jack later on.
It's true for a lot of actors, I'm sure.
We'll talk more with Carl Friedman, Versions of Hollywood Crime Cinema, and have some other information when we return on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Carl Friedman, LSU English professor and author of several books. His latest is Versions of Hollywood Crime Cinema, Studies in Ford, Wilder, Coppola, Scorsese, and others. Billy Wilder, a lot of people don't remember before he started making these lighter films. He was a crime guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he probably made more romantic comedies, although his romantic comedies are darker than most romantic comedies. But he probably made more romantic comedies than any other genre. But yeah, he made some very great crime films. The greatest, I think, is Double Indemnity. 1944. The definitive film about insurance fraud and, you know, murder and insurance fraud, with Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck and Edward G. Robinson. I write about that in some detail. Another of his great darker films, it's not exactly a crime film in the same way, is Sunset Boulevard, one of the great films about Hollywood itself.
That magnificent film with William Holden and Gloria Swanson.
Yes,
1950. Yeah, I'd rank that as one of the greats. But, you know, it's amazing how much good art, great art, some would say, comes out of times when that are turbulent, like Double Indemnity came out during World War II. During the Vietnam era, there were a lot of great films.
I'm not sure exactly what the relationship was, but the Vietnam era is arguably the greatest period in the history of Hollywood, the so-called American New Wave of the late 60s and early 70s. This was when people like Coppola and Scorsese and Altman and Arthur Penn and just, you know, a number of brilliant directors emerged. Stanley Kubrick was a little bit older, but was still very active then.
The book is Versions of Hollywood Crime Cinema from Carl Friedman, and a question from a listener who obviously knows about your previous work, Annie. She asked, did you like Frost Nixon?
Yeah, I did. I saw it in London on the stage, and I thought that it worked somewhat better as a stage play than it did in Ron Howard's film. Although I thought the film was pretty good too. It has the same cast of Frank Langella as Nixon and Michael Sheen as David Frost. I think the great Nixon film is still Oliver Stone's Nixon. But yeah, I thought Frost Nixon was.
You liked Oliver Stone's Nixon? Huh?
Oh yeah. I think that's one of the one of the great biographical films of all time.
And of course, David Frost died last week, at the age of 74. What a career he had!
Yes, indeed.
Well, Carl Friedman, we thank you. Look forward to your return as well. And you're a crime cinema guy and overall cinema person. So let's do this again soon. And congratulations on another fine book, Versions of Hollywood Crime Cinema.
Okay, absolutely. Thanks for having me. Look forward to being back.
And we're joined in our remaining time this hour with Renee Chatelaine, the director of the Manship Theater, and Wayne Talbot, the director of Fine Arts for East Baton Rouge Schools, and they're here to talk about a few things. This is the beginning of the Fine Arts Week in our school system. And Renee is recovering from last night's Full House with Dr. John.
Yes, it was really, really fabulous.
Dr. John at the Manship Theater and Edwin Edwards and Larry King at LSU and a lot of and the Lisette Oropesa event was last night as well. A lot of things going on in our community on a Sunday night.
And, you know, lots of things going on in our community, culturally, across the board. I mean, it's an exciting time to be in Baton Rouge.
Well, you and Wayne Talbot have been on the stage together.
Yes, we have. Yes, we have. Dancing with Big Buddy.
Yes.
And actually, you were one of the winners. Was this last year or
earlier this year.
And Renee has a career as a dancer in her recent past, but she's a good person to work with.
She's an excellent dancer, artist, educator, instructor. She actually turned me into Antonio, a Latin ballroom dancer, and made me a professional dancer, so it was great. It was a wonderful experience, and I'd do it all over again.
It was such a pleasure.
Well, this is a big week in particular for you, Wayne. What's happening this week?
It's National Arts and Education Week, and at last month's school board meeting, our board proclaimed this week. It's a national week, but we also are very supported by our school board in terms of the arts and providing arts education for our students. And one thing that I discovered when I became fine arts director 5 years ago, noticing I've been teaching for 35 years and the decline in our arts programming in the schools, and a lot of it's because of decline in revenue and budget cuts, and a lot of times those are the programs that we have to cut first, and I do understand that, but it gave me an opportunity to reach out to arts organizations in our community and ask for their help in terms of providing arts programming for our students so that all of our students receive some type of arts education or arts experience. And a number of the organizations in Baton Rouge have stepped up. We work very closely with the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. The Baton Rouge Symphony just recently has signed up to do an instrument drive for us because we are trying to start two new band programs, one at Scotlandville Middle and one at Bel Air High. And they're going to collect used instruments, and we're going to refurbish to try to get those in the hands of our students. Opera Louisiane provides student programming for us. The DeBose Foundation provides opportunities for our kids to be showcased. And just last year, Renee and I kind of joined hands, and because she's a former educator as well, Manship has stepped up, and we've built this great partnership where not only are we're allowing our students to perform in such a professional venue for our all-parish performance series, but we've also contracted with them to do some arts integration, arts education programming for our students. So Renee may want to talk a little bit about
that. Yeah, how will
that
work with the Manship Theater?
Well, you know, we have the unique opportunity to send professional artists who live here in Baton Rouge into the classroom to help teachers in their classroom setting enhance what they're already teaching through arts integration. And then those same students have the opportunity to come to Manship Theater and see some of the shows that relate to the lessons that they are learning in the classroom. So it all reinforces some of the core subjects that they do every day. And arts is a great way to enhance math and science and English and, you know, all the subjects that you would think of in traditional school settings.
Well, Ellen Galinsky, an expert on early childhood development, is in our community today. She has an event this afternoon at the Renaissance, and she was on the show last week and commented on how education has to have an arts component to be successful, that this is something that is vital to the development of children, particularly young kids. Do we sometimes neglect that?
Oh, I think that tends to be one of the things that people want to edit first when they see that there's trouble or there's a crisis in education. And what Wayne and the East Baton Rouge Parish School Board has recognized is that arts are a vital part, and especially with differentiated learning and setting up our students for success on a variety of levels, arts plays a really vital role. And Manship Theater is really we have the resources to be able to provide to these particular schools teachers, artists, enhance the learning, and then also provide them with an opportunity to experience international artists who come in. Our school shows, we have 10 of those this year, and they are traveling from Scotland, from Canada, as well as all over the United States.
And can I jump in on that, Jim? Renee and I are both products of having the opportunity to have an arts education as at the same time as having a strong academic education, and it really has influenced our lives. I think that's why we're so passionate about this, that the arts have to be an integral part of the education process, and the expert is right. The arts is another way of communicating. It's teaching children to communicate in a different way, either through movement or through visual forms or through expression in their music. And it's the same as learning how to read and write. There are certain skills you learn, but it's a way of teaching students literacy and communication in an alternative format. And it's proven that, you know, kids that get involved in the arts stay engaged in school.
Well, thank you. Wayne Talbot, the Director of Fine Arts for the East Baton Rouge Parish School System, and Renee Chatelain, Director of the Manship Theater. And we'll be back tomorrow for J.C. Kane. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.